ruler of Iran on the peacock throne, flees because he's not a particularly brave man. He flees to Rome. Dulles flies to Rome. He's busy shopping, the Shah, enjoying his exile with his glamorous wife. And Dulles is given the job of putting a little lead in his spine and getting the Shah to return to Iran after they finally succeed, the CIA, in overthrowing the popular leader Mossadegh. Well, after that, that begins a reign of horror then in Iran. Democratic elements, the left, Communist Party are rounded up, tortured, and the Shah is installed in this terrible autocratic regime that, of course, we know had a terrible downfall during the Carter administration, and we're still paying the price for the bitterness that the Iranian people feel towards the United States for intervening in their sovereign interests.
And the U.S. would go on, the Dulles brothers would go on to do the very same thing the next year, 1954, in Guatemala?
That's right. They were on a roll. They thought they could do anything, exert their will anywhere in the world. Jacobo Arbenz, again, a popular democratic leader elected in Guatemala.
We only have 10 seconds in this portion.
The Kennedy of Guatemala is overthrown again by the Dulles brothers. Partly because they were representatives of United Fruit. United Fruit was a major power player in Guatemala.
We're going to leave it there, but we're going to do part two, and we're going to post online at democracynow.org. David Talbot is author of the new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David Talbot is founder and former and editor-in-chief at Salon. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with their hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today's guest is Katrina Vanden Heuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine.
This Tuesday, Katrina Vanden Heuvel, editor, publisher, and part owner of The Nation magazine, will be live on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's this Tuesday, live on KBOO 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We have been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planrfp2015.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
All right.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. This is KBOO 90.7.
Yeah, it is.
On the FM dial in Portland. It is. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. Number to call, 231-8187. It is, after all, the talk radio show. But we have a guest.
We do. We have the editor and publisher of the venerable Nation magazine celebrating its 150th anniversary, Ms. Katrina Vandenhoevel. Thank you for
venerable.
Joining us this morning.
Venerable sounds too venerable. Good morning.
Venerable's a
too
little
venerable.
Scary.
Right.
We agree. It's a little scary. Little.
Well, hey, 150 years, that's something.
150 years is something. I'll say that. In this fast-shifting media landscape, it takes a lot to survive. But we were, founded not in Portland, though we're happy to be here for the evening, the event tonight, founded in New York City. In July 1865.
Well, I actually have a question about that. This is trivia, but I'm interested in this. I can't resist. Henry Villard, the power behind various capitalist enterprises, including the Northern Pacific Railroad. I think he bought the Nation in 1880 something.
You know, the Villards have a long history with the Nation. Oswald Garrison Villard, the great editor of the Nation, as of 1917 was someone who took the Nation in radical directions. He was a dissenter against World War One.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the founders of the NAACP, one of the founders of the ACLU institutions, which to this day define America. But there's certainly people in the course of the history of the Nation who were not pure, and I think that's part of the tradition, that you needed people who put aside what might have been their day job, a railroad magnate, to support the Nation in difficult times. And you get Oswald Garrison Villard, who I said mm-hmm. was a believer. If there is one consistent strand in the Nation's history, it's the belief that empire is toxic for democracy. And I think that's something that in different forms, you can call it empire, you can call it roaming and misadventures abroad, remains true today.
Well, more than misadventures at this point in history, it seems like the United States is pretty much dependent on empire. Am I wrong?
Well, what strikes me, to bring it into the moment very sharply, if I could, President Obama is accused, and the Nation has a lot of differences with President Obama on different issues. He was accused the other day, I think it was in a 60 Minutes interview, of being too restrained. Well, only in an empire would a president who has, undertaken bombing campaigns in seven countries, and in a country where we have 135 special op missions at the moment, would that be called restrained? So I think, it's part of a metastasizing what our longtime contributing editor, Gore Vidal, great essayist, he was consumed with the idea of empire, the understanding of the danger of empire, but, we have become an imperial nation. And I think we would do wise to think very hard about how we rebuild our country at home, step back from the world, not to be isolationist, but step back and take a measure of our own country and how we work with others before undertaking new missions.
This notion of empire is an intriguing one for me because this doesn't look like Britain, for example. We haven't gone around the world and planted the flag. We're not trying to make the world England. Nevertheless, though, I think the description of the United States as an imperial nation is apt.
Yeah, we don't, the idea of empire has gone through permutations through time. We don't have necessarily colonies, but we do go abroad trying to bear the flag of what we, the leaders consider, the elite, so to speak, democracy. But we have a lot of work to do on democracy at home, and I'm thinking one of the, coming back to the Nation for a moment, if mm-hmm. I might, I've been editor for 20 years, one of the defining moments for the Nation, but again consistent with its long history, and defining moments for me as editor was our unwavering opposition to the war in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth remembering, and we're all in the media, that there can be a very kind of coercive conformity that leads people to take certain views, and there's often very little room for dissent, for challenging the, quote, conventional wisdom. And The Nation was very clear in its opposition, one of the few major media publications to do that. And, you know, criticizing government in wartime is not a path to popularity, nor was criticizing the Patriot Act. So these are steps that we took, but in our DNA is what we've been talking about, in a sense, this not opposition to all wars, but opposition to reckless wars, a belief that military action must be the very last resort. And again, coming back to these last months, it was, in some ways, I find shocking how ferocious the opposition to a very straightforward, in some ways, deal with Iran to curb nuclear proliferation was. And the idea that we would go to war to stop nuclear non-proliferation is a militarization of thought that I think has pervaded too much of certainly the elite's thinking. If I'll stop, but I think there's a greater disconnect almost between the Beltway elite inside Washington, D.C., about the need to go abroad in military action. Well, millions of Americans in this country who I think want to be secure, but don't believe, for example, that they have a strategic interest in fighting for Kiev.
Well, yeah, that I want to segue into something really weird. Tonight is the first of not so many Democratic debates, so-called debate. I don't know what to call them, show trials.
No, look, if I women, let me just sit there for a moment. I think tonight you're going to see a debate played out on as progressive a terrain on issues as we've seen in our lifetime. Now, you always push for more, but almost every Democratic debate I can remember has been played to appeal to the kind of, quote, you know, moderate center, that kind of unicorn always being searched for. And tonight, you know, one could argue that Bernie Sanders has already won. He has shifted the debate. His issues will be addressed. They must be addressed by other candidates. Governor O'Malley hasn't gotten traction, but he too will speak in a more progressive way. And it's pushed the candidate who was considered inevitable a year ago. And a year ago, The Nation argued that what this country needs above all, first of all, is a range of ideas where so often there's a suffocating consensus, but contested primaries. And I think you see the benefit of that, or we will tonight.
Now, Hillary Clinton had a front row seat to the creation of the corporate-friendly centrist ideology that transformed the Democratic Party in the 1990s. So are you suggesting that the impact that Senator Sanders has had on the debate is so profound that it's pushing her significantly leftward?
I am. I'm suggesting that Bernie Sanders has changed the public conversation for the better. He's moved not only Bernie Sanders, but let's not forget it's not only a progressive moment. It's a movement moment. And I think that the movements for economic justice, against inequality, for racial justice, for climate justice, those have moved the candidates. And that's what you want. Now, there are those who say she's opportunistic, Hillary Clinton. I'm not going to sit in judgment. I'm going to say we, as voters, as journalists, as activists, you push to put long-neglected issues on the table. Bernie Sanders has focused his campaign on serious problems and offered serious solutions. And I think, you know, his candidacy has already changed the nature of the Democratic Party. Much more needs to be done. But, you know, we have editorialized in favor of a progressive challenger to Hillary Clinton for more than a year, and also changing the issues being debated. And all of this, by the way, without any negative ads, which will come. But Bernie Sanders is a longtime student of corporate media, understands that corporate media wants the bloodletting. They want celebrity spectator politics. They don't want issues. And so I think that's an important step forward, too.
Now, as a progressive, my fear is that at some point the Beltway establishment, the very serious people among the media elite, will decide that they've had enough of Bernie Sanders, and conventional wisdom will sort of coalesce behind a more moderate candidate, probably Hillary Clinton being the most prominent.
Do you know who we're into this year? Let's not forget. I think it's an extraordinary moment. I don't mean to be too rosy. I understand we're in the fight of our lives against corporate power for people's control of our government. We are in a moment where, what was the story the other day? Some 158 families have already contributed more than half to this election season. I mean, the money power is a plutocracy power. But that said, the establishment media is witnessing as it moves around the rules being rewritten around it. I mean, it is declared, and I'll go to this terrain momentarily, you know, briefly, because this past summer, everyone was so consumed with Donald Trump, no one could get any oxygen. But the rules have been rewritten, and I think the very serious people, first of all, haven't been very serious. They've been locked down in support of their agenda. But I think it's a fascinating moment. There's no question that the establishment is with Hillary, but what I find fascinating is how often Bernie Sanders has been declared unelectable. Now, he may not win, but his agenda, his issues are electable, and his issues are being listened to, heard for the first time by millions of people in this country. Why haven't they been heard before? Medicare for all, ideas that are too often quickly dismissed as socialist, because the corporate media hasn't been interested in the widest range of views that exist in this country being heard on corporate media. So I think we have a very interesting moment where at least it's a kind of teachable moment. I don't like that phrase, but, you know, thousands of people coming to Bernie Sanders rallies, you know, first of all, many young people and many people who'd never heard of him. Never heard of him. The nation's been covering him close on to 30 years.
Well, I agree with you. I want to shift a little bit. I'm thinking about Paul Krugman's term that the Republican Party is a post-policy enterprise.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, it really was.
I stuck on that too yesterday. He's used it before.
Yeah, he has. But I think it's very apt. And I'm looking at what goes on, the clown circus, and I can't call it anything else but that, with Trump, who's a dim-witted, wealthy guy who actually would have made more money in the stock market than in his trading properties and done less harm. But anyway, that this party is captured by this kind of sleazy, deliberately ignorant person, and that beyond that person, there's nobody with enough charisma to hold the line, to build a coalition on the right. At the same time, the base is fundamentally anti-republic, anti-government.
Well, it's you know, it's a wonderful, if you think back, there are several elements here. Our national affairs correspondent William Grider has a piece at thenation.com about how sort of the Southern strategy, which Nixon launched.
Yeah, I read it last night. It's brilliant.
Has come back to essentially destroy this party, but there's always been this unwieldy, jiggered coalition between a base and an elite, and the two wanted different things. I mean, if you look at what the base wanted, it would get shafted every election because the establishment would come in and do what it needed to do for its own purposes after promising a base all kinds of, you know, often unrealistic, you could argue, dangerous, bigoted things, and you're seeing that base bite its head, and it's fascinating to watch on historical, political, and other levels. I think to call it the clown car, and I do that too sometimes, I admit, you know, this is more a kind of confederacy of the fearful, the frustrated, the angry, and the bigoted. These are both the establishment and the base have one thing in common. I've always felt that the Tea Party, at its most benign, is a cohort of people who look out at a country they don't recognize anymore and want to find ways to fight it. And they do it with vitriol, they do it with hate radio, they do it with all kinds of mechanisms. The establishment is doing it by pumping money into things like voter repression. They want to keep the new coalitions in this country, the new demographic of this country, they want to keep it from playing a significant role as long as they can. One thing I do agree with, this is a post-policy party. I mean, Jesus, you know what, I'm going to get it wrong, but 56 times to votes to repeal Obamacare, no alternatives. And the Benghazi Commission, I think, is a perfect example of a party that uses witch hunts instead of policy. There is a legitimate reason to have a committee to raise questions about why U.S. foreign policy has become mostly one of regime change in a place like Libya and what the consequences are for our country and the region. But this committee, run by a character you just couldn't make up. I mean, if Terry Southern of Dr. Strangelove came back, I often think he would say reality has so far outstripped satire that he would hang it up. But Trey Gowdy, I mean, these people are, you know, got to wonder why they want to be in government. They hate government so much. They're denigrating government. They're destroying government and deforming government. And I've never been one who says throw a government out. I'm not. I think you take government back, you clean it up, you make it work for social, economic, and other justice.
So, continuing in the same vein, despite the fact that the GOP is so obviously a post-policy enterprise, as Kirkman says, the mainstream media nevertheless persist in maintaining this fiction of balanced reporting. I mean, the Republicans could claim that tomorrow the sun will rise in the West, but the headline might be, you know, some Democrats disagree. Do you see this changing anytime in the foreseeable future?
I don't. I see it. The tragedy, and it's something we could talk a long time about, but is that we've had more and more evidence of the fact that this party is post-policy, yet it is still treated as a serious party. And I think Krugman did in yesterday's column, Paul Ryan. I mean, Paul Ryan's budget, as someone in the New York Times said, is sort of about, you know, it's sort of made up of puppies and, you know, flowers. It makes no sense. It makes no sense. I think the most dangerous area we continue to see, though maybe little less in the last few years, this false equivalence narrative,
yes,
is in the climate area, where I think there's more exposing of the false claims of junk science, of corporate science, trying to deny that humans play a role in a climate crisis. But not enough. What's stunning is there's so much evidence in that regard, yet it is still played out on this false equivalence field too often. I mean, one of the great, well, you know, there'll be books written about this, but in the same way, so many have deformed the meaning of democracy by misusing it. Fox News is not the only culprit, but by using that term fair and balanced, it has so deformed those terms, and that has metastasized and spread into CNN and other cable networks. But I do think it's imperative that a serious media, and I distinguish that from mainstream or corporate, call out this false equivalence as often as it can. And it's important because I think one of the things it does is make people see government as fully dysfunctional. And I think that's a long-term agenda of the Republicans, to try and portray government as dysfunctional. But if you looked at the stories about South Carolina the other day in the wake of the Hurricane Joaquin, you know, people, when they need government, don't bash it. They remember its value. And I think what goes on in Washington often with the game playing, the failure to really do anything to address the condition of people's lives, is part of a long-term agenda to debase, to degrade, and make government seem like the enemy, as opposed to what Franklin Roosevelt said decades ago, you know, the government is us, but it's been captured.
You know, I think that this whole process of disavowing or dismissing government, I think, begins really in the public sphere with Reagan.
Absolutely. I think it begins with Reagan, though in retrospect, you know, there was more... it begins with Reagan. It begins with Reagan. In fact, I would say that in the larger sort of cyclical frame of our country's history, there have been two waves in the 20th century, and we're into the 21st, but one has been the right wing's effort to roll back the civilizing advances of the New Deal and the Great Society. And Reagan was certainly came at the in the second cycle. And we're now in a moment, and I do think it's a cyclical moment, where there is a pushback against the Reagan era, which of course lasted, extended beyond its namesake. If I could say one thing, the nation in the 80s was ferociously anti-Reagan, particularly in the context of the crimes going on in Latin America. I mean, in a whole, the crimes going on in this country, too. The defunding of legal aid, the assault on the poor, the degradation of the poor, the assault on so many, again, civilizing advances in this country under Reagan. But I'm struck by what's happening in Latin America, bringing death squads in El Salvador, in Guatemala, to justice. And the nation covered all of that. We had a great reporter, Alan Nairn, who covered the death squads in Guatemala, the CIA's involvement with paramilitary in Haiti, the death squads in Salvador, the killing of Jesuits, of nuns, by right-wing death squads in Salvador with complicity by the U.S. Just the other day, the release of documents showing that the United States CIA knew very well that General Pinochet of Chile was involved with the assassination of then-Chilean Ambassador Letelier on U.S. soil. I say this because in those years, the nation, others, allies in the fight for justice in Central America, in the fight to bring the United States to international court for bombing Nicaraguan waters, we were called communists. Communists. We were called un-American. But what we're seeing revealed in these last years, in court documents, in the work of activists in the region, even in the work of the Pope who canonized Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was a leading voice and killed in fighting death squads. We're seeing that the rehabilitation of justice has also come with the rehabilitation of memory and the rehabilitation of work we did and others did to try and bring justice to victims of American violence, but also more important, there's the America that stands against imperialism, that stands against human rights abuse. And I think I don't want to just say those who believe in progressive human rights and justice must claim that these revelations to show that justice can be done, that history has cycles, and that governments almost always lie, and that media is critical. Media is critical to right wrongs and bring truth to bear.
This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. We're talking with Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. She's in town tonight for Literary Arts celebration of the nation's 150th anniversary at the Newmark Theater. That show is unfortunately sold out, but will be recorded and viewable next week on thenation.com. Katrina, I'd like to follow on what you just said about the importance of media and of journalism. You've seen your craft change dramatically in the last 30 years, first with the rise of the 24-hour news cycle on cable television and broadcast television, and then with the rise of the internet. How has the nation managed to navigate these changing journalistic waters and also to remain vital and vibrant and continue to report on what's really important?
Very good question. It is quite something, as I said when we started talking about to survive in this fast-shifting media landscape. No question that the media world, the media landscape, is undergoing extraordinary tectonic shifts. But what I think has kept the nation alive and thriving is a ferocious independence. That has been one of the keys to the nation's longevity. And I think it's become ever more important in an age when it's when dissident and rebellious voices need to be amplified. We also are a place, we're committed to providing a venue for passionate arguments between liberals and radicals. We have a readiness to fight and refight the same battles, a persistence that permeates every page. And also, I think one thing change is inevitable, but a constant in the nation's journalism. has been a faith not in political parties or policies, but in what can happen when you tell people the truth. All of that said, one of the steps we took on our birthday, July 6, 1865, was our actual birthday, but 150 years later, we launched a state-of-the-art website, thenation.com, in the belief that we wanted our independent, fearless journalism brought to a new digital age, to a new generation. And I have been determined to bring The Nation into the 21st century. We have younger writers. We've just brought on an immigration rights reporter. We have a climate justice reporter who's all of 21. We have a Student Nation Network, 60 correspondents across campuses.
You just brought on Joan Walsh.
Joan Walsh has come on, which is very exciting. And Kai Wright, a great editor from Color Lines, determined to bring on younger writers, writers of color. So I think that what we're doing is promoting younger writers, promoting great writers like Joan Walsh, appealing, I hope, not just to young readers, but to those who seek a feisty alternative to what is often in the mainstream. And we're engaging with the issues and social movements that inspire the passions of young people. So I think, you know, the advent of digital publishing, social media, in my mind, offers a historic opportunity to reach vastly larger audiences, to have a greater impact. Now, and to tell stories in different ways. I mean, one of the things we're doing this 150th anniversary is there's a documentary called Hot Type. It showed in Portland Monday night, I believe, Sunday night. Hot Type, 150 Years of the Nation, made by Barbara Koppel, great filmmaker who made Harlan County, USA. But it's another way of showing our story, of telling our story, of telling the story of journalists, in this case, one who goes to the drought in California, to Haiti, to Wisconsin to tell the story of the uprising, the first Occupy in many ways in the statehouse there. And then tells the story, which we've done in our pages in different ways, but in this case video, and we're doing more multimedia, but of Moral Mondays, a great movement, if your listeners haven't heard of it, a great movement, kind of pro-democracy, voting rights, multiracial, in North Carolina, led by Reverend William Barber. And he's in the film being interviewed by one of our reporters. So I think, you know, we're staying true to investigative reporting, which takes time and resources. We're staying true to coverage of movements, of opinion writing, of deep reporting, and all the while doing it on different platforms. We reach about a million people a week now on different platforms, and our site is booming. You know, the monetizing of all of this, a word that makes me reach for my hair and try to pull it up and out. I think that's one of the crises of our journalism at this moment. What are the models for survival? We have a very, you know, listen, anyone listening, please come to thenation.com, contribute. But we have something interesting which Bernie Sanders has seen the power of. We have a network of about 20,000 small donors, small supporters, and we have something called the Circle of 100, almost a theatrical production, which includes people who give about $5,000 a year for 3 years. So, you know, we're building a network both of people who value The Nation as an institution, a community, as a journalistic media outlet, but, you know, they support it for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, I want to come back to what you believe.
Can I say one thing? I was
sure. No, go ahead.
I flew out yesterday, and it was lovely to come into Portland. It was kind of solace for the soul. I don't recommend people get on a plane and watch the Amy Winehouse documentary and then watch a documentary on Richard Nixon back to back, and then listen to, well, Taj Mahal and Aretha Franklin. That's good music, so I recommend that. But I was reading the paper also, and it's interesting to me because there's going to be a little bit of a wavelet of nostalgia. There's a film coming out called Spotlight, which is about the Boston Globe's, I think, 14-year quest, crusade, to expose the abuses within the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And the film, you know, shows the old style, you know, what was it called, you know, trench, you know, the old style foot leather, shoe leather reporting. And there's a reference to how there's sort of a nostalgia for that kind of newspaper reporting, almost like when the newspaper trucks go out at the end of the film, I think, with the final revelations, which finally, you know, really nail it, and the paper wins a Pulitzer and all of that after 14 years, a lot of resources. You have a sense of the power newspapers used to play in our society. And I think that was an important power. And I think what one of the things we've lost, for the most part, and you saw it in the Nixon documentary, is you had an institution like the Washington Post, or in this case the Boston Globe, powerful institutions which were primed and able to be a countervailing force to government abuse. We have that, but it's more dissipated. And I think we need to think hard about resources to ensure that the media remains a robust force, exposing, making right what is wrong, and all of those. I wouldn't call them old-fashioned, because that is at the heart of a certain kind of journalism.
I agree with you. For years I used to contribute to the Oregonian, which is,
yes,
you know, very established. In fact, I think I wrote a small thing for your publication once upon a time, a while back. But the paper folded in essence as a newspaper and turned into a kind of a tabloid, very weird tabloid, in fact, right now. And I'm seeing this happening all over the Daily News in New York, all over the place. Newspapers, physical papers, are folding up. Not that they aren't profitable, but they aren't profitable enough.
Well, that, see, that, I think, I was struck about a month ago reading the story of the L.A. Times, which, again, I think, in a reckless, wrong-headed step, began to lay off people. But the paper was managing a 13% profit. So I think this is insanity, because the drive for ever greater profit margins is incompatible with a great journalism. I'm reminded of that tonight. Ursula Le Guin, the great writer, the science fiction writer, will be part of the Nation event at Live Arts. And she is someone who, in a great speech, if your listeners haven't read it, maybe you have, but I think it was the National Books Award last year, she spoke about the danger of a publishing industry demanding ever greater profits and how it squeezes out artists who have visions, artists of resistance, and the commodification of literature, of art, of ideas, of journalism is incompatible with the greatest service of journalism, the greatest beauty of literature. I know I may sound like a unicorn, though that has a different meaning now too, and I'm not a small startup seeking venture capital. But I do think it's not utopian. I think it's the measure of a strong society, of a democracy, that it values above high, high profits, the demand for ever greater profits, a state of journalism, a state of literature. 1996, The Nation did a first of several issues called the National Entertainment State. We ran our very first centerfold. It was not what you might expect of a centerfold. It was a four octopi, representing the four major media companies at that time, Cap Cities, Disney, Bertelsmann, News Corp, Viacom. And it showed that news was a tiny cog in those corporate entities. And I think that alone says a lot. And we see it ever more now, because those great corporate entities, let's admit it, on one level have a lot of regulatory business in Washington. On another level, it becomes a danger of obliterating the line between entertainment and news. And you mentioned Trump. He's the perfect vehicle for that, right? Isn't he? I mean, he just is a one-man show for embodiment of what's happened to so much of our media. We saw it play out. We've seen it play out before. So I think newspapers have a right to make a profit. Business has a right to make a profit, though it's good to see new forms like the B Corporation, which has a triple bottom line to community, planet, workers, but still make a profit, not huge. But I think we need to think hard about whether these entities, like journalism at its best, can exist in a high-wire, high-powered profit framework.
I think you're right. In fact, I think that kind of journalism is an essential component of the social contract as we understand it. And seeing that standard degrade over the years, I think, has had a corresponding a negative effect on our ability to reason well as a body politic.
No, I mean, I think you're right. I think tonight I write a column, a weekly column for the WashingtonPost.com, and I said, you know, on the eve of this debate we were talking about earlier, so much of the commentary has been about, will sparks fly? Will it be entertaining?
Right.
You know, it's almost as if we're entering a drinking game. You know, take two shots for every time they mention Benghazi, three shots every time they ask Bernie Sanders, how do you square up being a socialist and being the next president?
I thought that was just the way you watched a debate.
Exactly, yeah. But, I mean, but the idea that politics is a spectator sport goes back to what you were saying. Listen, journalism doesn't need to be spinach, but it does need to inform a society. It does need to play a role in intelligent, enlightened debate, discussion, arguments. And I think we've lost a measure of that. On the other hand, I don't want to be too nostalgic about a time when you had a lot of institutional gatekeepers. I do think the balance is often off in terms of the polyphonous voices in our media. And who do you trust? And do you even trust? I mean, you trust but verify, and that's part of the role of journalism. But I do think we're at a moment which goes back to Krugman's kind of post-policy, post-truth. Post-truth is a very dangerous terrain to be in. And I think, I hope the nation plays a role in trying to bring to bear quality journalism, a commitment to a journalism that informs, and with a great group of writers who are also committed to those values.
Well, it's an interesting dilemma for me interviewing you. I'm thinking about, and I'm often very, very depressed about the situation, not just of journalism, but the objective situation of this country and its function in the world as things, I think Naomi Klein put it, you know, this changes everything, as things clearly are going bad. Not just difficult, but bad. We're still all about the selfish gains of a very, very powerful small number of ruling class. I don't know what you want to call them, oligarchs. It is terrifying. Meanwhile,
go ahead, interrupt me, please. Please interrupt me.
I'm sure you have this feeling too. I am not an optimist, but I am a hostage to hope. And I couldn't get up every morning. I wake up every morning and believe there is another world. There is an alternative. And you fight for that. I also believe what someone we endorsed in 1932, Norman Thomas, he was a socialist. We then went on to endorse Franklin Roosevelt in three consecutive terms. Norman Thomas once said, I am not a champion of lost causes. I am a champion of causes yet to be won. And I think we're in that kind of moment. I think you can look out at the world, you can look out at our country and despair. But you can also look out now, and I'd say unlike 10 years ago, you can see people in motion, you can see movements in motion, you can see some change. And I think, yes, the structural forces will demand extraordinary change, but you begin. And if you don't begin, then you end. And you have to begin somewhere. This, in a subset of this, if I might, I think it'll come up in the debate tonight. You know, the power of money in our system, the power of polluted, big corporate money unleashed by a Supreme Court, which has turned right. But John Nichols, great national affairs correspondent for The Nation, who will be emceeing tonight at the theater, you know, he always says, let's repeal Citizens United. And in fact, I think 16 states, 500 cities around this country have pushed for an amendment to overturn Citizens United, and all power to that. But I said to John, you got to give people hope that their work in the next weeks, months will also make a difference, because repealing a court decision via an amendment is a holy nightmare. It's really hard. It's worth work worth doing, but it's hard. So take other steps. There's steps along the way. There's good legislation people don't even know about in Congress, which would empower all kinds of people in this country to be able to run for office because of public financing, a system, by the way, which we have in New York City, my longtime city, which has allowed, for example, seven women of color to be elected to the city council, We hear a lot about Mayor de Blasio, the progressive mayor, but the city council has been changed because of this match system, a dollar to six, public financing. And it's a system that allows ordinary people, I hate that expression, to run for office, and not just those supported by the Koch brothers. So I say, let's wake up, let's take a tough, cold-eyed assessment of the state we're in, but not despair, and do the work.
Well, I can't argue with you.
Forgive me. It's not Sunday. That wasn't a secular sermon. I'm not that big into self-help, but I'm sorry if it sounded like that. But I really feel we're at a moment where people can't sit back and be spectators, which, by the way, as we talked about earlier, too much of our media wants them to be, don't you think? They want people to be spectators.
Oh, absolutely. They want us to be passive and buy stuff.
Yep.
And I years and years ago, I was in New York, and I happened to meet Dorothy Day, and I was involved a little bit in handing out food stuff, and just a bunch of stuff. I did some work with the Corps and a lot of different things at that time, going to Columbia. And she said to me, and I'm a grump, and I always think it's going to go bad. Okay, I've believed that now for a lot of years.
I hear you.
And she said, you know, we Catholics believe there is such a thing as the sin of despair.
Ooh, that's good.
And I think it's good. I think it's really important.
Sin of despair. That I will say, what is extraordinary, if I might segue to this moment. All right, who would have thought that a pope would come to the Congress and invoke, yes, Lincoln and Reverend King, but Thomas Merton and Dorothy Day?
Yeah, no, that was cool.
This is hope. This is not despair. But what struck me, and I will not draw a one-to-one parallel between Bernie Sanders and Merton and certainly Dorothy Day, but millions of people for the first time heard her name, and I saw in the Washington Post, for example, they did a full spread on who she was. This is how change begins to happen sometimes. People don't know of those in our history who have made radical change, who have believed in the power of a just religion. And when people find out, it's very powerful. And that's my one quibble, I will say, with Bernie Sanders. When he's asked why he's, you know, what does it mean to be a democratic socialist? He talks about Sweden, all power to Sweden. I hear they just passed a plan to abolish and end all coal, oil, gas, and move to renewables. But there is a long tradition in this country's history of public ownership of utilities, of the right to have health care, the right to have a job. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944, your listeners might check it out, the Economic Bill of Rights. I don't know if he'd be driven out of Washington today, because I think the times have changed a little, but certainly a few years ago he would have been. It was essentially a Bill of Rights calling for the right for all Americans, every American, to have a right to work, housing, health care, and more. And so I think in some ways Bernie Sanders, with the exception of climate, which wasn't on the agenda back then as it might have been in the New Deal years, is an unreconstructed New Dealer. And you find in our traditions, like a Dorothy Day, what an extraordinary part of an American tradition that isn't lifted up enough. And I think that is vital. And that's why, again, the Nation, people have a chance, go to thenation.com. We published a special issue on the occasion of the 150th, which I have to say is almost a kind of alternative history of this country, a real one. It's not made up. It's real ideas that haven't been in the textbooks as much as they should be. People, voices. And I think prophetic voices and those who have pushed for change and then seen change come and then, as you said, have despaired because the cycles have pushed back and reaction has pushed back against them.
Yeah, you know, I really like that 150th issue. I'm so old, so old. I got the 100th issue.
When we were planning the 150th, we had copies of that. And I've been to yard sales where people still had it but I'm pleased to hear that. Any case, I didn't mean to go on, but Dorothy Day, you met her?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, she's, I was very influenced. It's interesting. I'm an atheist. I'm a born in New York Jew. I grew up within the purview of what used to be called progressive, but was also essentially communist politics during the 30s and 40s. I've been active, but also extremely cynical, and always thought that it was bad, which gives me the opportunity to say, but in 1944, what the Democratic machine did, the Southern Democrats together with the Eastern city government organizations and so on, did to knock Wallace out of the running for vice presidency when everybody sort of knew that Roosevelt was not going to be around too much longer. That was, for me, the historic turning point away from the possibility of social democracy. And I wonder if you have thought about that and what your comments might be.
With Henry Wallace?
Yeah.
I think that was a turning point in those years. It was also, again, within a framework of a time when the nation really stood tall. The nation received, if I could just for a moment, received the Freedom from Fear Award from the Roosevelt Institute last 2 weeks ago. It's part of the four freedoms: freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of religion,
freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg received the overarching Courage Award. But in that context, talking about freedom of fear, freedom from fear, I go back to what you were saying, that what you just mentioned regarding Henry Wallace was very much in the framework of a time in this history, which many of your listeners may remember, McCarthyism. McCarthyism, a time when the fear of the other, a stigmatizing of those with other views, certainly a calling of those people alleged to be communists by congressional committees, this fear stalked the land. And that fear of the other, let's not forget, is with us today. You know, you have this horrific Islamophobia, you have other phobias. But we argued then that fear has always been used as a weapon to subdue the hard-fought civil liberties that truly make America strong. And I think in many ways Henry Wallace became part of that frenzied witch hunt period. He was alleged to have all kinds of communist ties. But the bottom line, and Victor Novasky, the former editor and publisher of The Nation, has a brilliant essay in the 150th anniversary issue based on his longtime study of the impact of the McCarthy period, or as he says, some call it the Hoover period, the more we know about J. Edgar Hoover.
Really?
The more, but what it did to the what it did to exclude ideas that should have been part of our politics and society. For example, health care for all. It was too easily stigmatized in those years as a communist idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or ideas that should have been part of our political landscape. So I think we're seeing more of an opening. Now, I don't want to say post-Cold War, because I think we're in a second Cold War with different implications for this country and the world. But I think there is more opening now to different ideas, especially among a younger generation who looks out at this country, and they haven't seen the American dream. They've seen very grimly what capitalism means, which is why a recent Pew poll, I think, showed that with some 46%, 47% viewed socialism positively.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and 47% had a negative view of capitalism, and some 49% had a positive view. Now, that requires fleshing out what it means, but I think there's a willingness, I may be, again, in unicorn land, to look beyond labels and to actually look at Medicare for All, what it means, for example, for free higher education, or how do you deal with the student debt? So there's an openness to ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Henry Wallace rejection, what you were saying, was a very critical moment in a critical part of our history. But again, in these cyclical motions, I think we're still left with a legacy, no question. But that legacy has more to do with how ideas have been excluded from our landscape. And Bernie Sanders, to a certain extent, again, when you look out at the world, Europe, for example, this anti-austerity party called Podemos, or even in Britain, the Labour Party, the new head of the Labour Party, there are more radical ideas out there. But Bernie Sanders is certainly beginning to bring ideas which haven't been heard enough in the broader landscape of this country into that landscape.
Well, I agree with that. I'm gonna ask you to help me with something. I've had several people say they wanted to get a copy of the 150th anniversary issue of The Nation, and I didn't know what to tell them. I'll bet you could.
Go to thenation.com, and you will see information how to get it, and or email art, A-R-T, at thenation.com, and ask how to get it. art@thenation.com. Tell them Katrina sent you.
Okay, so that's great.
So as we wind down here, let me just follow up on something you just mentioned. You mentioned young people.
Yes.
I'm very much of the opinion that our salvation lies with the under 30 set, who across the board on virtually every issue imaginable are incredibly progressive. What's your take on that? And what, you know, will that youthful idealism and that progressivism be enough to prevail?
I sure hope, but I think one has to remember that within a generation, there are many different strands. There, I think you have the young people really fueling these movements, this movement moment. I think they're more open-minded, but I think a lot is going to depend on how things shake out, sort out. One of you, Abe, you mentioned cynicism.
No, that was me. I'm
sorry.
Yeah,
I think, you know, I think we could be in a moment where, you know, if not idealism, but a willingness to fight, to have convictions, to have passion, to really get out there and express. I see it with the climate justice movement. As I mentioned, we have a 21-year-old reporter, writer, who is just traveling the country, talking to people, a leader of this divestment, reinvestment movement, you know, take the money out of fossil fuels, move it into justice and renewables. You see it in the forefront of the Black Lives Matter movement. So I think there's hope. But again, it's going to need to see, not how do you define success? I don't want to say that. It's going to need to see some sweet victories along the way. It's going to need to see some change happen because of the idealism, the passion, the movements. But I do have hope. I do have hope. And I see it in the, you know, 30 interns who come through The Nation every year. I see it in the student Nation writers. But I hate to generalize because I'm aware this is a huge country, and, you know, there are all kinds of forces. I mean, I don't want to speak for the third generation in a coal mining family where the idea of just transition, you know, if someone reaching out to coal miners and saying, hey, we're going to find you, train you for new jobs, that's, you know, a hard sell these days. So I think there are people around this country who may not be in as straight a mode as you described.
You know, we had an interesting victory here, which I'm sure you know about. We, it may be too symbolic, but nevertheless pretty effective, which was this kayakers.
Oh, my God. I'm talking about it. I mean, I want to make reference to it in a respectful way tonight. I mean, you're talking about those kayakers who took on Shell, mm-hmm. the huge multinational oil company.
And Greenpeace, of course.
And Greenpeace, and who stopped them from moving their poisonous oil, am I right? I think.
Well, it's a drilling a support ship, to put it simply, and of course that was a unfortunately more symbolic than real. But Shell now is backing off temporarily because they haven't found the rich vein. I don't know what you call it, rich pool of oil that they hope to get quickly.
Yes. No, I think that was an important. I think civil disobedience. And I think activism like that, as you said, it showed the power of a small band of people to make change. And it may not have made the structural fundamental change, but it stopped Shell Oil for more than 36 hours.
Yeah.
And you see what's happening in other ways with these companies on the defensive. And I think all of this plays a role. And I think this city and the Pacific Northwest is also played an important role, not just in that way, but, you know, in the fight for affordable housing, for progressive growth, in, you know, the fight for 15, what's going on with the minimum wage would not have been, you know, you couldn't have foretold that a few years ago. And I think Occupy, which erupted just a couple miles from the Nation's office in New York, though it was a movement that crossed the country. I never felt when people talked about Wall Street. I said, hey, it's in Bloomington, it's in Portland.
I'm sorry, but we've actually run out of time.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm sorry I went on.
No, it was wonderful to have you.
It was great to be with you, and thank you for your work, and may we stay allies.
Indeed. Congratulations on your 150th anniversary.
Thank you.
And feel free to join us anytime.
Thank you.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
The Western Regional Advocacy Project is celebrating 10 years of fighting for affordable housing and against the criminalization of people who are homeless. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the RAP 10-year anniversary concert featuring Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, October 17th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center. RAP is a national leader in both street outreach and grassroots organizing against homelessness. KBOO will be live streaming the concert from our website. Again, that's the RAP 10-year anniversary concert, Saturday, October 17th, 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, located at 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under KBOO Community Events.